Well, so I basically, I was giving myself a master's degree in business because I would read everything I could get my hands on. Because, see, I was traveling all the time. It was a very lonely existence. And so I was reading all these books. So I was basically giving myself a master's degree in business because no one was teaching me how to do this. I was having to learn it on the job. Mm-hmm. So it was very, it's always been very rewarding to me that even yet, and it doesn't happen much now, but for many years I might be traveling and somebody would come up to me and say, I'll bet you don't remember me, but you gave a speech to our group in Atlanta, Georgia that changed my life. Well, that makes you feel really good.
So you feel as though you had a positive impact in influencing other women.
So I had my one mentor. Well, I had more than that because I had my father, I had my home ec teacher, I had other teachers in the school, I had professors at Purdue. And so I then had the opportunity to be a mentor to thousands and thousands of people because of the opportunities that I had. I guess people used to say, you're so lucky. I thought, well, I'm also willing to take risks. And every job that I took, I didn't know how to do. It would have been easy to turn that down and say, well, I don't know how to do that, and I might fail. But I never thought that I would fail.
Do you think that risk-taking is an important part of success?
Oh, absolutely, without any doubt. And I think this is a problem that one of the big things that women have had to overcome is they had to realize that it was okay to have someone say no to you. It was okay to fail. It was okay if they started a business and it failed. Well, lots of people start businesses that fail, and they may their first 10 businesses of men who've been extremely successful may say, the first three businesses I had went bankrupt, but the fourth one worked. And my husband, John Burkhart, loved to tell that story that his first business was started during the Depression and went bankrupt, and because of that, the only way he could pay off his bank loan was to get a job that paid a commission, and that's why he started selling insurance, and then, of course, he eventually founded a very large insurance company and did all kinds of wonderful things.
When did you marry John Burkhart?
I married John Burkhart in 1985, and he was 76 years old when I met him, and I was 50.
And you met in Indianapolis?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. 1983 to 85, you were the founder and owner of the Women's Investment Network.
Yes. So I had 3 years at Borden in Houston, and then they transferred me to the corporate office in Columbus, Ohio. Mm-hmm. And they had a reorganization, so the food and dairy division were made one division. And they had some reorganization in the top part of the company. And so they put me into strategic planning. So I ended up in a job I never intended to do, in a city I never intended to live in. Both of those were things that I did not choose, you see, which was very interesting. So I stayed there for 2 years because, again, I realized I would learn a lot doing this, and there wasn't anything else that I knew that I wanted to do. And so I stayed there in that position. But then when I realized that it was time for me to move on, that being in a corporate office is quite different than being in a branch office out, you know, in Houston, Texas, where there are 20 people. And so then I decided to move back to Indianapolis. If I was going to live in the Midwest, I'd rather live in Indiana. And my parents were elderly, and I needed to be closer to them. And so I moved back to Indianapolis, and I decided I was a consultant when I came back, again, to Mr. Jen, who had sold Jen Air, but he had other companies. Mm-hmm. And I did two consulting jobs while I started this business of Women's Investment Network to provide financial services to women. Well, again, this was just at the cutting edge of things where women were just beginning to make some decent money. Married women were beginning to realize they needed to know something about their family's finances, and so it was a very interesting business that
This is personal finance management.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes, but what we did was a combination. See, I've always used teaching all my life. I'm basically a teacher person because I always like to tell people how to do things. And so they joined as a member, and then we had classes of all kinds where they could come in a non-threatening situation to learn about all kinds of insurance, about securities, bonds, how to read the financial pages, what the stock market, how it functioned, you know, all those kinds of things, without someone trying to sell them something. And then we would analyze their finances. We had certified financial planners, and we would put the information in the computer and explain to them that based on their income level at that particular time, and at the time that they said they wanted to retire, this was what their income would be. But then they had this number of years to change that in number, and then we would talk about how they might be able to do that. But we did not sell products. We gave out information.
People were buying a service for them.
They were buying a service, right. And it was going quite well. Then I met John Burkhart and decided, we decided to get married, and I decided to close the business because it was the kind of thing, it was new enough that it really needed me to make this work. You know, it was one of those 20-hour a day kind of things. And I realized that I didn't quite know what my life was going to be like at that point. So I wanted to be available to travel and to do whatever we were going to do. And so started over again in a whole new life.
As extrapolating from your resume, you retired in 1985, is that right?
Right.
At least as an active business person.
Right. I thought I had. That was until I became a publisher.
Well, I didn't say you stopped working.
Right.
I'm very careful, not to say that.
From that phase of business, yes.
Well, do you think that what I might call the developmental trajectory of your career, was it all typical for women in the 1960s and 70s?
Oh, no. Women were inclined to take a job and stay there, you know, and retire from the company, as men did, too. But I like to, my favorite word was new, and I love new ideas, and I love, one of the things that I think I got from my father was the ability to think in a big picture kind of thinking, and think about, you know, to have vision and to see not only where I was going, but where other things might end up being and what role I might have in that. So when I ended my work time, my career in 1985, was when I really got involved in philanthropy and in civic causes, because my husband still went to the office at 7 in the morning and came home at 6 in the evening. And so I had all this marketing background.
In his 70s, he was still doing this.
Yeah. And I had all this marketing background. And so, of course, I was just hot stuff for all of these organizations, nonprofit organizations, because they couldn't have afforded to...
It seems to me, having read your resume and talked to you at your country club and visited with you now for something over an hour, that your career development was not typical of women of your generation.
No.
So, do you think that you were an exception because of your particular strengths as a person and your personality, or that you were on the cutting edge of changes that happened to you maybe a few years before they happened to other women?
Combination. I think that I definitely was gifted in my ability to organize and manage and to see the big picture. And so that no matter what I would have applied that to, because as I applied it to nonprofit organizations as a volunteer, again, it was, I always ended up in these leadership roles. So had I never worked at all, I would have always been in leadership kinds of things. I started doing that when I was 6 years old and started to grade school when my peers and my teachers would ask me to lead things, you know, because I knew how to make things work and how to make them happen. And I was very fortunate that times were changing for women, and I was able to participate in that change and was excited about it. And I think because people saw me doing things successfully would ask me then to participate in whatever it was that was happening. That's part of, you know, if you're going to do something, you do a good job with it, and just because you want to do a good job with it, but then other good things always happen as a result of that. So it was just a lot of things that, you know, a combination of things.
I mean, obviously, no matter what your skills as a leader might be, somebody has to want them in order so
that's
the,
right.
the changes in society were helpful, but do you also see yourself as an agent of change?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
In what ways?
Well, I'm a very creative thinker, and so I spend a great deal of time now, even though I've tried to cut way back on my involvement in nonprofit activity, because you can work, I mean, every hour of every day and night for nonprofit organizations if you want to, you know, because there's that kind of need. So I, even when I cut way back, it seems that no matter what I get involved with, then I get deeper and deeper into it, because I don't just go sit in a meeting. I always have ideas that are workable ideas. So, it isn't that I do premeditation about, well, I'm going to go to such and such meeting, and so therefore I've got to come up with all these ideas so that people will be impressed or something. That's not the way it happens at all. I go to the meeting, and I know what the meeting is going to be about generally, but while I'm there, that's the way my mind works, is to suddenly I have insight about a solution, and I'm a very good problem solver. And so I'm very practical, and I know, because I've done so many different kinds of things now, I know what will work and what won't work. I know how to put certain people together to facilitate things happening, how to have organizations collaborate for greater strength, the whole system, the idea of synergy, and so it's, yes, I am definitely a change agent, and I love change, and I think it's very threatening to a lot of people, and of course then I become a threat, or I might be intimidating, because I'm excited about change, and for people who are fearful of it, they don't want to be around that, you know, and I'm aware of that not everybody welcomes the...
Is that a representative challenge to you, particularly as you work for not-for-profit?
Yes.
Run into people who resist change or want to do things the way they've done it because that's the way they do it?
Yes, but it happens more with the staff that are of the organizations than with the other volunteers. But it would happen if I was in a for-profit situation. It's more comfortable for most people to, you know, continue doing things the way they've been done, and rather than having to change.
Do you consider yourself to be a leader?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I'm not the least bit fearful about being a leader, but I'm also a very good follower, and this is something that surprises people, because many times good leaders only want to be the leader. They have no intention of doing anything else. I am thrilled to be a follower, but I don't want to follow someone who doesn't know what they're doing. And it's very, you know, you see very quickly whether the person that you might be following is going to be a good leader or not. Now, if they're a good leader, I love it, because I always learn something. I find that I can bring my strengths to their strengths, and they're excited, I'm excited, and then I don't have to have that responsibility of leading the whole thing. But if it's a person who doesn't know what they're doing, rather than challenge them or make it uncomfortable for them in any way, quite often I will just move on and do something else, because I feel that everybody needs the opportunity to learn how to be a leader. I don't have to lead everything, you know, and I happily don't want to.
I'm wondering in what ways your first career in business and media and advertising and so on influenced you or helped prepare you for your second career in philanthropy.
Oh, well, all my life, the whole career thing was a building process. It's just like, I used to laugh and say, it's like I'm pulling this little red wagon, and I just keep putting skills in it. And with each job, I would bring along with me the things that I'd already learned how to do, and then I would add new things. And so, for instance, when I went to Gen Air Corporation, I added on the component of learning about manufacturing, learning about sales, learning about the whole arena of consumer services, about research and testing. All those things went in my wagon. So then when I went to Borden, I had all of that already in the wagon, but I got to add on this worldwide travel and this big picture of working with the legal departments and all of the things that were a part of that job. When I started my own company, I learned more than I'd ever learned in my life, and I learned that I spent a lot more time worrying about how I was going to pay my employees than what I went there to do, which was a very good lesson. But you know, that's another point, and that is that I think that really successful people are never afraid to start over. And I've done that so many times in my life, realizing I'm just kind of starting over again. But you're not starting from the same point ever. So that when I married John and I left my work world behind and my secretary and all of my support system and went into doing all these things in the nonprofit world, I had no secretary, I had no help. And I didn't start out being on boards. I started out at the bottom of doing publicity for a committee that was planning a gala. And that is quite...
Do you remember the first organization you volunteered for?
Yes, the Family Support Center. No, wait a minute. I take that back. Big Sisters. Mm-hmm. I was on the board of Big Sisters before I was married to John. But that's quite a shock when you go from being a powerful executive to doing the publicity for a gala. You know what? But my point in this is that... the willingness to start at the bottom, the willingness to clean the windows, if that's what that group's doing, is very important. And to never think that just because you were at the top of one particular thing makes you the top of everything. And then, you know, after a couple of years in the nonprofit activity world, they recognized that I brought a lot to the organization, so then they would ask me to chair the event, and then they would ask me to be on the board of the main organization instead of being just in the women's organization. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's a hierarchy in the nonprofit world. There are the women's organizations that do the fundraising galas, and then there's the big board, we called it, that like in the case of Family Support Center, that actually had to do with running the center itself instead of the women's organization that had to do with the...
Were the women's organizations your entree into the, mm-hmm. the not-for-profit, mm-hmm. like philanthropic world?
Yes, other than being on the Big Sisters board, mm-hmm. Which was a mixed board of men and women.
Mm-hmm. You, between 1992 and 98, you were the owner of the Register?
Yes.
Could you explain what that was and how it functioned and what you did? Mm-hmm.
Well, after 7 years of being married and being on the board of so many things and actually creating a lot of major fundraisers for the city that are ongoing, that's one of the things I'm very proud of, is that an idea that I have had and started something, and it is still going on after 10 or 12 or 15 years.
For example?
Well, for example, the Indianapolis Art and Antique Show. I founded that. It was not my idea. The president of the organization asked me if I would do that.
Which organization?
The Methodist Hospital Task Corps, which is the women's organization there. And So I spent 2 years. I knew nothing about antiques. I knew nothing about antique shows. So again, it gave me the opportunity to do the research, organize the group, figure out how to make it work, and do it, which is what I repeat over and over and over, whether it's starting a business or whether it's doing something like this for a nonprofit. And it is now in its 12th or 13th year, and it's raised a huge amount of money for the hospital. Another thing that I founded was the wine auction for the art museum, the major fundraiser for HealthNet, which is the series called The Bazaar, starting out with the Grand Bazaar Istanbul, and every year it's a different country, and it raises over $100,000 now in a year. And a lot of other things that I've been involved in at the beginning that are ongoing and unique to that particular organization. And that's very exciting for me.
Do you think that's the strength that you have, is to get things going? Mm-hmm.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And people know that. And
you're sort of a launcher of activities?
I am. Well, I'm an entrepreneur of that particular kind of thing. But again, you see, it uses my whole background. So I know that it has to have this in publicity, and it has to have this. In fact, one of the fun things that I did was the first Paris fashion show ever held in Indianapolis as a fundraiser for the symphony. And that, again, was a two-year project. And it was very successful and very exciting to be involved with. And but leading up then to when I had the register, so I had had all this experience in nonprofit organizations at that point. And my husband had been involved in publishing. And so I had invested in this little paper called The Register, and it had only two issues, and it folded. But it was one of five papers that this company had, and I was the only investor in that one. So I ended up with it. Now, I could have just said, well, I lost that money, but my husband said, well, you own it. There's not much there. You know, it's a name, and it's a format, but it didn't have its own staff or equipment or anything. He said, well, I think you'd really have fun doing that. Why don't we just go ahead and do that? And I didn't know anything about publishing or running a newspaper. You know? So there I was, starting over again. And so I did it for 6 years, and it was a monthly publication that was, some people perceived it as being a society kind of a paper, because we did have a lot of pictures of people going to social events, but they were fundraisers, most of them. Some were purely social, but most of them were fundraisers for organizations. And so it gave me an opportunity to present to the public of what these organizations do, and then what they do with that money that they raise. But it also, I hope, helped people understand that those people that get dressed up and go to those fancy events, they're not only giving up their money to be there, but their time to be there. They could be at home watching TV or reading a good book. And a lot of people just didn't understand that. They just thought, oh, those rich people out going to those fancy events. So we were able, and it became more and more focused on philanthropy. And we did a lot, I think, for the community of having... and we had a circulation of, I don't know, 75,000 or something like that, of readers. Because if we distributed 35 or 40, I think maybe 45,000 papers, you can easily just double that as far as readership is concerned.
How was it distributed?
It was free. Mm-hmm. And the first 5 years of its life, it was in stacks. It was at grocery stores and places, you know, where free publications are in racks. And then the last year we did a collaboration with the Indianapolis Star where it was delivered to homes. But it was, I had development people tell me with organizations, nonprofit organizations, that we basically told a story that allowed them to easily raise the money. That we helped people understand philanthropy, and it made it so much easier for them to raise money.
So if you had to summarize the mission and purpose of the register, how would you do that?
It was to, and we had a mission statement, now I can't remember what it was, but basically to present nonprofit organizations and philanthropy to the public in a way that helped them to understand the role that they played in the community.
Was anybody else doing that at that time?
No.
In any other cities?
No.
What happened to the register?
Well, my husband's health was failing, and I ended up having to also run two other business publications that he was involved with. And so it really became very difficult for me to do all of that and take care of the things that I needed to with his other businesses, and his health was failing. And so we sold all the publications, and the person who purchased the register still hasn't done anything with it, and I don't know whether they will or not, which isn't my problem, but but it went away, and which is kind of a shame because it did a lot of good in the community, and people love seeing pictures of people, you know, going places and doing things. It was, you know, as soon as it would come out at the first of the month, everybody would grab their copy and turn to the back and see whose pictures were in there, and whoever was on the cover, and was always a prominent person, whether they were the head of some nonprofit organization or a leader in some way in the community, but not business-wise, but it all had to do with philanthropy and nonprofits, would tell me that, you know, if they were on the cover, they could not believe the letters and phone calls they got from both men and women saying, "Saw your, you know, picture on the cover of the register, congratulations," you know, and so we knew we had a huge following, which was very exciting.
You said that you found yourself as the owner of this paper that had published a couple of issues, mm-hmm. and basically was in big trouble. Where did you get the idea that devoted to philanthropy?
Well, because my life has never been, you know, I didn't grow up in a country club environment. Remember, I grew up on a farm. The only time I'd ever been in a country club till I met my husband, John Burkhart, was my brother belonged to a little club in Vincennes, so my first wedding reception was out there. So I wasn't a country club person. I didn't play golf or bridge or tennis. I worked. And so it would have not been my personality to have made that just a social newspaper, because my life has always been, had more depth than that, and I have a lot of friends who are country club, what I call the country club ladies, and they're very nice and they do wonderful things, but I always have this altruistic streak, you know, that says everything has to have some value to it. So if we can sugarcoat these lessons, since I'm the teacher, and have it look like a social newspaper, fine. Mm-hmm. I remember I had a television show once that was called the Indianapolis Top 500, and it was a diet club on television. Remember, I was doing these things before anyone else was doing this kind of thing, and it was behind the scenes, because I was home economist, it was called a community nutrition project. On the air, it was called Indianapolis Top 500, because it started January 1st and ended May the 31st for the 500's sake.
Right.
But then I used all these professional people in different ways to talk about diet and exercise and all this kind of thing. And again, understanding the difference between forcing education down the throat and making it entertaining.
How did the register pay for itself?
Oh,
if you
didn't.
Gave it away for free.
Well, advertising.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we would have hoped that it would have paid for itself through advertising. It never did.
I didn't frame that question very
right.
clearly, but I mean,
well,
money has to come from somewhere.
Yeah, right? Advertising. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we did have a few subscribers who didn't want to have to go to the store and pick it up. You know, we mailed it to them, so we had some subscribers. But you would hope, you know, that advertising would pay the bills, but we didn't quite fit into a normal niche, so it was pretty hard for us to make that happen. And so it was a labor of love on my part. It cost me a lot of money.
Do you think that the Register made a contribution to the field of philanthropy?
Absolutely.
What do you think their contribution was?
For people to understand more about what the word means, and to understand the nonprofit organizations and the money that comes in through them does for our quality of life in the community. And we talked about that all the time. Everyone's life is enriched, whether you go just, if your life is just involved.